Morning, Council. The final case on our docket this morning is Lucius Taylor versus the State of Ohio. And as you can observe, the Chief Justice has recused on this case, and filling in for her is Judge Harsha from the 4th Appellate District. And if you were not in the courtroom earlier, Justice Lanzinger is viewing the cases directly by her computer back in Toledo. She had good reason to be in Toledo last night, and she will be participating in the deliberations this afternoon. And if nobody else asks, she's even got a couple questions for counsel. So with that, counsel, proceed.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Neil Agarwal. I represent the appellant, Lucius Taylor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the facts of this case are relatively very simple. Lucius Taylor stole $550 worth of merchandise from a department store. He was properly indicted on a felony of the fifth degree count of theft. It was a felony five because it was between $500 and $5,000 at the time he committed the offense. When he pled guilty to theft, at that time, House Bill 86 had gone into effect. House Bill 86 had raised the threshold from a felony five theft from a minimum of $500 to $5,000 to a new category of $1,000 to $7,500. The trial judge, recognizing that House Bill 86 was in effect at the time of the sentencing, reduced the offense from a felony five down to a misdemeanor of the first degree, and Lucius Taylor pled no contest to that offense. The state appealed to the Court of Appeals, who partially reversed, saying that under Revised Code 1.58B, a defendant is entitled at the time of the sentencing to be resentenced as amended under House Bill 86 as far as the sentence only. The sentence was properly sentenced as a misdemeanor of the first degree. However, they said that the classification of the crime, that it was a felony of the fifth degree, should stay in place rather than a misdemeanor of the first degree. Now, it is our contention, Your Honor, that the trial court was correct and the Court of Appeals made a fundamental error. The statute in effect here that we're dealing with is 1.58B that says that if the penalty or punishment of an offense is reduced by an amendment of the statute, the sentence, if not already imposed, shall be imposed according to the statute as amended.
Where do you find the penalty for misdemeanor?
I'm sorry,
which code section controls the penalty, the confinement penalty for?
Well, the theft statute itself,
no,
29.
No, which statute controls the penalty for the misdemeanor theft offense? Isn't it 29-29-24?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Does House Bill 86 amend 29-29-24?
No. As far as I understand, what we're arguing is that House Bill 86 says that for looking at the theft statute, it is amended in one of two ways. If a defendant is convicted after House Bill 86 goes into effect, which would have been September 30th, 2011, or if Revised Code 1.58B applies, then you apply the amendment. And we're not disputing he committed the crime after September 30th. He didn't. He committed before, so we then decide, does 1.58B apply? Now, we're arguing there is a difference between a penalty and a punishment. And this court has said that the legislature, when they give statutes in various terms, must give effect to every word. Now, the state in its brief is saying the word punishment and penalty are synonymous and there's no difference. We're saying when we're talking about the sentence imposed, that would be the reduction of the punishment. Well, then what is the penalty? We are saying that the penalty is the going from the felony five down to the misdemeanor one.
Couldn't the penalty mean a dollar amount as a penalty? For example, a fine, as opposed to punishment being jail time? I mean, couldn't we make some distinctions about what those terms mean?
Well, we would say that a punishment is including of the possible jail offense or prison offense, as the case may be, or a fine. A fine is part of the sentence, or a possible of the sentence. But the classification, we're saying if you're going to make a distinction between the differences of a penalty to a punishment, then we're going to say there is a difference between the sentence imposed and the classification for that sentence. Now here, there are numerous collateral disabilities that are associated between having a felony compared to having a misdemeanor.
Counsel, I think we can understand that there are differences, obviously, in being convicted of a felony versus a misdemeanor, and that there would be disabilities out there that might be associated with that. But what precedent do you rely on to say that's the same as having a change in that a change in the classification and being called a felon is the same as a change that you would see in terms of jail time, for example, or another kind of penalty, whether it was a fine or imprisonment? What precedent do you rely on to say those are the same?
Well, actually, we're just relying on statutory interpretation. There is no case law that has interpreted the statute, Your Honor, from this court.
Well, I get that doesn't, you wouldn't have it under this particular set of circumstances where you have House Bill 86, but is there anything in any of the decisions that we've ever ruled on that make those two things the same?
Not as far as I could find, Your Honor. Now, again, if the lower court said, and they didn't really define it, but they said really under 1.58B, punishment, penalty, forfeiture, however you apply the statute, it's only a reduction in the sentence actual. Now, again, the statute does not say if there's a reduction in the sentence. It just says a reduction in the punishment. So we're saying punishment is linked to the sentence, but it does not say what is the link to the penalty. The Court of Appeals said the classification is separate and apart from 1.58B and therefore in no way is affected. Well, we're saying a penalty is part of the classification. Why? Because there are, again, getting back to the collateral disability, you lose your right to vote, the right to be a juror. You lose your right to solicit petitions for elections, the right to own a firearm, the right to even get a barber's license, Your Honor. You could not, and I have listed in my statute scores of statutes that the legislature said, if you get a felony, you are prohibited from being a doctor, engineers, board of trustees, you are forbidden from being a police officer. All of these job disqualifications flow, and they are penalties. If you are being impeached, Evidence Rule 609A, there is a difference of impeachment if you have a prior felony compared to a prior misdemeanor.
So the basis of your argument is that the word penalty means offense classification.
Correct.
And if we agree with that, wonder why we wouldn't have the legislature incorporate offense classification into that statute.
I think they could have, absolutely. But you have
they
to,
didn't.
They didn't. But they didn't say reduction of sentence either.
So we now have to say that penalty means offense classification in order for you to prevail.
Correct.
And if we don't go there, then what?
Well, then you would have to somehow distinguish what does penalty mean that's different than punishment.
Well, the appellate court here left the classification as it was, but permitted your client to avail himself of the misdemeanor sentencing provisions. Am I right about that?
No, they said the Court of Appeals actually said that his punishment should not have been a misdemeanor. The trial court sentenced him as a misdemeanor. They said it should have been as indicted as a felony of the fifth degree. So they're actually saying
it should have been punished as a felon.
I'm sorry, what?
And punished as a felon.
No. No. They kind of like split the baby. They're saying there's a classification and then there's a sentence.
I thought that's what I asked you. They, in the Ninth District Court of Appeals, determined the offense classification would remain a felony, but permitted the penalty sentence to be imposed according to the misdemeanor provisions.
Correct. But I want to just clarify. They didn't say that it should remain a felony. They told the trial court it should have been raised up to a felony.
Okay, and that's the problem that you're raising with us is only the classification of the offense that your client was convicted of. You're not worried about the penalty.
Well, no, in fact, all parties are in agreement that he gets the lower sentence.
Okay.
No one is disputing that penalty or the punishment under the statute means the sentence. And we're agreeing it is an M1 sentence. The question, it doesn't make any sense to us to say you get the M1 sentence, but you get the F5 classification.
As a matter of fact, it didn't make any sense to the Fifth District Court of Appeals either, correct?
The Fifth District, the First District, the Second District, the Sixth District, the
11th
District.
You're here on a certified conflict because the Ninth District said, okay, you get the lower dollar amount, but you're still going to be a felon.
Correct. Okay. Right. And I cited in my brief, Your Honor, a U.S. Supreme Court case as persuasive authority, U.S. versus Dorsey. This dealt with a sentencing classification that reduced the cocaine powder versus the cocaine and rock classifications down. And the question in that case was, well, between the time you're charged and the time you're pled or convicted, do you get that benefit of that new sentencing? And the Supreme Court said yes. And they said so for a number of reasons. One is, the purpose of the legislation was to reduce disparities between people convicted before the new law or those right afterwards. By applying the new statute of sentencing, you eliminate that. You also have to remember House Bill 86 here, the purpose of the legislation was to reduce the cost of incarceration, reduce the cost of the crimes. We have reduced the threshold.
It was to reduce the prison population because they were 33% over, but over capacity. Wasn't that the basis of it?
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons. But it also reduced.
We had an $8 billion shortfall in the state budget, and we had to try to find a way to do it. So the idea was we won't prosecute individuals as felons.
That is correct.
And we'll just change this.
Right, and we raised the threshold from 500 to 1,000 for felony fives.
But at the time your client committed this offense, he knew that he was committing a felony.
Yes. And again, we're not disputing that at the time of the offense, it was properly indicted as a felony of the degree. We're saying, what is the effect of 1.58B that says at the time of sentencing, you apply the amended statute? Amended statute as far as sentencing and as far as classification.
Okay.
So if there's no further questions, I would reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cassay.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, Richard Cassay representing the state of Ohio in this case. I want to clear up one possible misconception or area of inquiry. Lucius Taylor, what happened in his case, Judge Gallagher found him guilty of a misdemeanor over the state's objection and imposed the misdemeanor sentence. Summit County Prosecutor's Office filed a motion for leave to appeal with the Ninth District under 2945-67A. Now, that statute disables us from appealing the final verdict, so we could not change what had already been done to Mr. Lucius Taylor. But we could appeal, if the Court of Appeals allowed it, the substantive reasoning or substantive law behind the trial court's decision. So that's why we got into the Ninth District, and that's what ultimately led to the Ninth District.
Counsel, let me just conceptually get inside this case so I can understand what happened. On sentencing date, the trial court had before it a finding that this person had stolen or misused $550 worth of stuff.
Correct.
On that day, in the state of Ohio, that was a misdemeanor, correct?
On that day, if that offense had been committed subsequent to September 30th, it was indeed a misdemeanor.
And so the trial court therefore said, looks like a misdemeanor, sounds like a misdemeanor, here's your misdemeanor sentence. You're now guilty of an M1. You get sentenced appropriately. You, as the prosecutor's office, are saying at the time of the offense, that was a felony. So he should be a felon. Is that why we're here today?
We are here today because we have a disagreement over the meaning of 1.58B, and also a disagreement, excuse me, with the courts of appeals who have, and I'm specifically referring to State versus Solomon here, which for most of it is a wonderful opinion. Because they analyze 1.58B in great detail,
and they come to faint praise there. Huh? What?
And they come to the conclusion, the correct one, that 1.58B does not encompass or affect the classification or degree, and they do that in a very common sense fashion by looking at the dictionary definitions of punishment, penalty, or forfeiture.
And Mr. Kaseya, that brings me back to the original question that I asked.
Yes. You know,
everyone has conceded in this instance that the penalty, the sentencing, is appropriate.
Yes.
But I want to know where House Bill 86 directly changed the penalty. All it did was change the classification. The penalty is found in 29-29-24, not 29-13-02.
That's correct, Your Honor. The penalty for a first-degree misdemeanor was not changed.
So my ultimate question is, shouldn't we be using a parallel analysis if we're going to use a very broad interpretation to determine that the statute affects a penalty? Why wouldn't we use a very broad interpretation to determine whether penalty and classification are so inextricably related that they are one and the same?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons, at least as far as the state is concerned. Let me start to answer that question with reference to uncodified Section 4 of House Bill 86. Now, uncodified Section 4 has two paragraphs. The first paragraph talks solely about the amendments, and then it lists the statutory sections. The second paragraph talks about the provisions and the amendments. Now, the appellate courts who agree with Mr. Agarwal, some of them interpret the second paragraph in uncodified Section 4 to indicate some type of implied legislative intent to apply the amendments retroactively and apply them to any defendant who was not sentenced as of September 11th or September 30th, 2011. That language is, the amendments do not apply to a person upon whom a court has imposed sentence prior to the effective date of the section. So what these courts do, they twist that around and they add words, and it means, in their view, that the amendments do apply if sentence has not been imposed.
Well, why do you suppose the legislature even made a reference to Revised Code 158B?
Well, under that view, there's no need for 1.58B. Right. If the amendments are retroactive, then what do we need 1.58B for?
1.58B provides for partial retroactivity.
It does. It?
Yeah, okay. Now, my point being here, if that 1.58B... it's going to operate as a matter of law, correct?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
It's going to be effective, and it's going to operate to reduce the sentence as a matter of law. There's no need to reference that in the statute, is there?
As long as the legislature is not bound by 1.58.
They could override it, but they didn't do that in this case.
They did not do that.
Okay, so again, there was no need to reference 1.58B in this statute if All they were concerned about was the sentence. That was going to happen by operation of law.
Well, that I can agree with that. The sentence would be the same, and we are.
So you're saying that that reference is surplusage, that it didn't mean anything to the legislature?
No, I'm not trying to say that.
What's the purpose of it then?
The purpose of 1.58B is to, in the state's view, expresses a legislative intent that the persons who have not been sentenced on or prior to September 30th get the benefit of the reduced penalty, punishment, or forfeiture.
But that's what 1.58B does. It's on the books. It's already
yes.
there.
Yes. And, but the legislature does not have to give that benefit. That's my point.
Well, isn't it reasonable to read the language in House Bill 86 to mean that if a person gets the benefit of the reduced penalty by virtue of 158, all the amendments then apply? What other reason would there be for putting that language in the statute other than to simply say, well, we're going beyond what House Bill 150 or Revised Code 158B would do by itself? We're now incorporating, it makes sense to us if we're going to have a scheme and you're going to be penalized under the scheme, let's use the whole scheme, not part of the old statute and part of the new statute.
I think my answer to that question is it requires a retroactive application of the amendments in House Bill 86, the ones we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think that's what you have to get to that point to do that. Now, as I was saying, these courts that do this, they are rearranging the language in the second paragraph of uncodified Section 4. Implied retroactivity. Now, to the state's view, there's no such thing as implied retroactivity. The statute 1.4A and every decision from this court requires a clear and unambiguous legislative expression of retroactive application. You do not have that here.
So the magic word has to be there. Retroactivity has to be.
No, the legislature doesn't have to say we're making the law retroactive, but the intent has to be clearly expressed. And it cannot be clearly expressed if a court has to find it by implication. That's my point.
There's no implication in saying that 158, the reference to 158B is a concrete indication of retroactive intent. I mean, it's surplusage if it's not.
It is partially retroactive because it reduces the penalty, punishment, or forfeiture. It is not retroactive in the sense, in the state's view, that it swallows or encompasses the degree or classification of the offense. Now, Mr. Agarwal, in part is saying that, well, it's the penalty that's important here because the penalty is equivalent to degree or classification. Well, says who? This court never has done that. When you look at those, penalty, punishment, and forfeiture are not defined in the revised code. So, again, going back to what the appellate court in Solomon did, it applied the dictionary definitions of those terms and the dictionary definition of degree, which includes classification when you talk about it in the criminal law. They don't fit. Yeah, they're not synonymous.
The majority opinion in the Ninth District really doesn't discuss much at all. It just says, well, the statute says penalty, so therefore that doesn't mean that the classification gets drug along with it, period. It doesn't discuss what does penalty mean, could penalty include classification? Unless I'm missing something, it just sort of says it's not there, so the trial court was wrong.
Well, they're not quite that brisk, Your Honor. They cited the Fifth District, or I'm sorry, the Eighth District cases, Seinfruth and Saplak, if I'm pronouncing that right. But they relied on those cases to conclude or find that 1.58B does not encompass degree or classification. Now,
would you agree, counsel, that when a court labels you as a felon, that is a penalty?
That is a penalty?
Yeah. I'm trying to breathe some life into the English language here.
If a person, or if I'm labeled a felon, would I call that a penalty?
Opposing counsel in their brief goes at great lengths as what baggage that brings with it. You lose an awful lot when you become a felon. For example, we wouldn't be here arguing if the classification had gone up by the General Assembly, would we? Let's say it was a misdemeanor when he committed the crime and it's a felony now. You wouldn't be arguing, well, then we're going to use the new statute because now you're a felon.
No, that would be ex post facto. We cannot increase the penalty. We cannot increase.
Well, everything we're doing here today is ex post facto, sir.
I'm not following that question, Your Honor. Everything we're doing is ex post facto?
Well, of course it is, because the trial court was saying that what was a felony is now a misdemeanor. That's an ex post facto finding, is it not?
But it's not an unconstitutional one.
Well, so it's not adversely ex post facto.
It's not ex post facto in the sense that Mr. Taylor would be impacted as he would be if, in your example, the trial court said, well, it used to be a misdemeanor, now it's a felony, I'm going to put you in prison instead of putting you in the county jail. That's unconstitutional ex post facto. That didn't occur here.
But Mr. Cassay, let me direct your attention to what we're trying to resolve here. A number of appellate districts have taken a position adverse to the one you're advocating for us.
Yes.
How many more of these cases are there in the system, in your view? Any?
Well, potentially, this whole situation is triggered by a sentence subsequent to September 30th, 2011. So who could be impacted or who could be affected?
It would seem to me that most of those cases have already either been indicted or pled or sentenced.
You would think so, Your Honor, but
my question is, I don't know that. I'm asking you what in your experience or what in your
my best guess?
What in your case inventory is relevant about whatever we decide here? Aren't these mostly finished?
I think it is mostly finished. However, this could reach a defendant who committed the offense covered by these amendments with at any time within the relevant statute of limitations, 6 years. So we could be going back 6 years where that offense is not discovered until now. And
in other words,
if
you found some stale evidence and finally get the DNA match on something, perhaps it might raise one of those cases. Is that what you're telling us?
I'm trying to tell you, Your Honor, that I don't think there's a large number of cases now, but I can't say there are none. It's impossible to say.
And whatever we decide in this case does not affect Mr. Agarwal's client?
No, it does not.
So we're going to make a prospective decision for a very limited number of cases going forward as to what 158 means in the application of this statute.
That's one way to look at it, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you.
Mr. Agarwal, you've got about 3 minutes left to offer rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honor, I cited on page 2 of my brief the ordinary Webster's Dictionary definition of penalty. Specifically, number 2 and 3, I listed the disadvantages, sufferings, handicaps imposed upon an offender as a fine or forfeit, and any unfortunate consequence or result of the act or condition. So we are saying that that penalty applies to a felony classification. And this court held in State versus Goldston, it said, in addition to the various statutory disabilities imposed upon those convicted of a felony, the infamy and disgrace resulting from a felony conviction seriously affects a person's reputation and economic and social opportunities in our society.
Counsel, what if we disagree with you on that point, and we say that penalty just refers to the actual sentence that was imposed, and it doesn't go to these other disabilities that might arise? Do you lose, or do you have a fallback argument?
Well, it will not, as Mr. Cassay said, it will not affect my client in any way. It will be an M1, and he'll be sentenced as M1, and we're done as far as he is concerned. So in that sense, it's a win for him regardless. However, as a matter of law, we're saying it's a loss, then if every time the legislature is reduced the penalties, that he still gets the F5 classification. Now, a question was raised, well, is this a very limited number? In this case, I would say yes, because House Bill 86, in effect, but in the future, the legislature says we're going to raise it from a $1,000 threshold to a $3,000 threshold, we will be right back here again on all sorts of new clients coming in saying we get the benefit at the time of sentencing. So while the applicability is to this facts may be dwindling as time goes on, the applicability of the statute does not. It would affect all future legislation, and it would define what they can and cannot be sentenced for. So in conclusion, Your Honor, I would ask this court to reverse the Ninth District, uphold the 1st, the 2nd, the 5th, the 6th, and the 11th, and as far as my client, but it's the law to be reflected that it should be a misdemeanor of the first degree.
Thank you, Mr. Agarwal. The case is submitted. Thank you, Judge Harsha, for being here and participating with us today and assisting us in deciding this case. The matter will be submitted. The marshal will adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.